lawn mowers and the leaf blowers are going, so let me know if it's a... So I enjoyed the discussion very much this morning, and found it quite stimulating, and I hope you did as well. And so for the talk right now, I was given the suggestion from Barry to address the question, does Buddhism still aim for nirvana? Does Buddhism still aim for nirvana? So it's a little tiny question. And when I first was thinking about it, I was reminded of a friend who is a Zen teacher. And he is from Ireland originally. Now he lives here in the States, but he's from Ireland originally, and he's from a very large Irish Catholic family. And I think two of his sisters are Catholic nuns. And so he goes back to Ireland quite often and does some Zen work in Ireland as well, and some reconciliation work. But he told me that on one family visit, one of his sisters, who was a nun, kind of buttonholed him, you know, confronted him and said, tell me right now, do you believe in God? And I looked at him and I said, well, what did you say? And he said, well, I said, tell me your definition of God and I'll tell you if I believe in it. And I think when we talk about Buddhism, we talk about nirvana and these concepts, it feels important to get clear about what we mean and reflect on what we mean and the various meanings that these, you know, especially the term nirvana or the Pali nibbana, how they've been understood over time. And then how do we understand it? How do we relate to these ideas? I appreciated in the morning Barry talking about the value of stepping outside of our own tradition, you know? And sometimes we can be so inside of something that it can be very helpful to have a perspective, you know, whether it's from various philosophers or different traditions, you know. And I appreciate the background that Barry has, not only as a Zen teacher, but also in the world of psychoanalysis and psychology, psychiatry. I'm a little bit in two traditions myself. Having a Zen practice and beginning to teach some in the Zen tradition. And also I teach and practice in the Western insight meditation tradition, you know, Vipassana, which many of you are probably familiar with, which has its roots in the Theravada. So, you know, early Buddhism. And Theravada is practiced now primarily in, it's the Buddhism that comes from Thailand, from Burma, Sri Lanka, you know. And the Zen tradition is more of an East Asian, from China and Korea and Japan. So for myself, it's been an interesting journey to practice in both the Zen tradition and the Theravadan tradition, and to kind of grapple a little bit with the different worldviews, somewhat different worldviews. And for myself, I would say, or I would hope, I think, that they've been complementary. you know, so they each have stimulated me in different ways. Part of the reason I'm bringing this up and what Barry said about going outside of our tradition is that part of being a Dharma practitioner and becoming mature in the Dharma is getting very clear about the model of practice that we're operating within. You know, maybe we could say as a principle of Dharma practice, we're moving in the direction of more awareness, right? You know, to be more and more aware of what's going on inside, what's going on around us. And part of that awareness is making conscious some of the assumptions, some of the models, the story. And if practice is something that's important to you, that's a part of your life in an important way, to become very aware of what's the model that I'm practicing under. And so I would say for myself, being in these traditions of the Theravada and the Zen, the model of practice and the kind of assumptions has a big impact on how we experience practice, how we understand the goal of practice, the way practice unfolds. I think it's fair to say that in the model of early Buddhism, and that the Vipassana tradition comes from, it's a model of it's a model of progress. It's a model of a path, you know, and you know the basic one of the basic meditation instruction manuals that's very important in the Vipassana world is called the Progress of Insight. So you know, right there. The progress of insight, and you know, and there's 16 stages, and you know, if you're working with a teacher who's classically going through, you know, oriented towards these stages, it's very clear that you go from this stage to this stage to this stage, or you don't, or you stay up this stage, and it's this model of kind of going from delusion to enlightenment, right, and. And then I would say the Zen model is, I don't know if you would say it's the path of no path or, you know, but this idea of that, as Barry was saying, ultimately any idea of a path that's taking us away from right here and right now ultimately needs to be seen through and let go of. A few years ago, there was the 50th anniversary celebration for the Berkeley Zen Center, which is one of the Zen centers where I did some of my training. And we all got these t-shirts. And the t-shirts said, Berkeley Zen Center. Berkeley Zen Center, accomplishing nothing for 50 years. You know, so and there's the story of at Berkeley Zen Center and the founding teacher Mel, you know, in the early, you know, it was pretty kind of pioneering place of a community Zen center in the 60s that was started by Suzuki Roshi along with Mel Weitzman. And there's a story of when the Zendo was in this old building, old kind of Victorian house in Berkeley, a police officer noticed that the lights were on, you know, 4 a.m. and was wondering what's going on. So checked in and asked Mel, what's going on here? And Mel said, oh, we're a Zen center. We're having meditation right now. And the police officer said something like, I used to come over here because this was like a kind of a drug. There was a drug deals happening here. And then he looked at Mel and he said, you're meditating, huh? Wouldn't you get there faster with drugs? And Mel said, you know, we're not going anywhere. right? Not going anywhere. So this is, you know, this is another model of practice, another understanding of practice. So I also have been inspired in what's helped my understanding of Dharma practice and Zen very much is this idea that Barry has talked about of a curative fantasy. I think you kind of, some of you will be familiar with this idea. But this idea is that we come to Dharma practice, we come to Buddhism because we're suffering, right? You know, everybody comes to Buddhism because they're suffering and wants to not suffer. And so we tend to, in some ways, maybe we could say misuse Dharma practice as a way of, you know, maybe in a somewhat understandable, but somewhat unskillful way to protect ourselves from suffering. So this idea of having a curative fantasy, and then that there's a way that when we hear about something like nirvana, which is presented, you know, by the Buddha, by the, you know, these Buddhist teachings as the end of suffering, right? The place of peace, the end of suffering, the ultimate refuge. And this can sort of become for us as the ultimate curative fantasy. You know, it takes the place of all the other, you know, ways we're trying to so-called rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. And then nirvana becomes the one thing. If I only get that, that's the fill in the blank, right? You know, whereas before, maybe it was, if I only get the right partner or the right career, or if I can just fix my health or, you know, relationships, then I'll be happy. But then nirvana takes this, you know, if we're into practice and we've taken on practice, it's like nirvana becomes like the ultimate curative fantasy, the ultimate dream of autonomy and protection. So this question of how do we relate to the idea of nirvana as a goal of practice, and what relevance does this have for our life? In a way, I'm going to be critiquing a little bit the views presented by Martin Haglund, or you know, I feel like he presents this idea of Buddhism. The goal of Buddhism is to attain the state of nirvana where nothing matters. To attain the state of nirvana where nothing maters. The goal of nirvana is to extinguish your life and attachments, not to lead a free life with the risk of suffering, but to dissolve into the timelessness of nirvana. And I think that, you know, so he's critiquing this idea, and this is kind of a life-denying idea, and it's this escape into something that's timeless. And I can understand where he gets this understanding from, because if you look at the early Buddhist teachings, nirvana is presented as the, you know, the way to escape the wheel of life, right? The wheel of rebirth. And you don't want to be born again. You don't want to be living basically in this world of suffering, right? So that's certainly there. That's certainly in the tradition. And I think the word nirvana or nibbana has the meaning of something to go out or to be extinguished. And this is usually understood as being paired with the Buddha's fire sermon. You know, the world is on fire. The senses are on fire. The eyes, the ears, noses, everything is on fire. old age as far as sickness, death. And so where can we go to be safe? How can we escape to this and be free? I'm guessing that many of us probably don't have the worldview of rebirth and transmigration of lives, and so it's worth questioning what is the meaning? How can we understand or relate to this idea, which seems to be very important in the tradition, right? The goal of practice. And so one idea or one understanding is this comes back, so one of the synonyms for nibbana is freedom. And Hagelin talks about this idea of, he's criticizing this idea of trying to find a freedom that's free from the vicissitudes of life, right? And that's free from suffering. Perhaps one way we can understand nirvana, or one way that I relate to it, is that it's pointing to a freedom, and it's pointing to a freedom from, but it's a freedom from the forces in the mind, the forces in the heart that keep us separate, that keep us at a distance from our life, that keep us separate from what's true. If I live in a way that I'm a slave to my compulsions, to my greed, to my fears, to my delusions and stories, and I'm not free, right? I'm actually stuck, I'm caught. So for this understanding of nirvana, it's freedom from the addictions to the story of this separate self. It's freedom from certain kind of compulsions, including freedom from the fantasies of control and autonomy. So when I think about nirvana this way, that it's actually an absence of something, a profound absence of, the classical understanding of nirvana is the cessation. What's a cessation of suffering? But it's the cessation of the suffering that comes from our clinging, from our greed, our hostility, our delusion. So it's an absence of something. So it's a little hard to talk about. How do you talk about an absence, right? It's not a thing. It's not a place. There's metaphors used. It's a place, and in the early Buddhist tradition, it's understood that contact, having the experience of this absence, when we've lived almost every moment of our life sort of inside something, to have the experience of that not being there, that absence, is a kind of profound, profound thing, profound reference point of freedom. And in the early Buddhist tradition, there's this sense that a person, through the practice, a person can so thoroughly uproot this clinging, this greed, hatred, and delusion, that they're kind of, they're done, And I don't have that sense so much in the Zen tradition, of this kind of ideal of a fully, permanently awakened, awakening. But I think it's there as well. But certainly in moments, we can experience this absence. I wanted to read I wanted to read this very short teaching, which for me is if I were the kind of person who printed things out and put them on my wall, I would put this on my wall. This is from Seng San, who was the third ancestor in the Chinese Zen tradition. And he's more famously known as the author of the great practice poem, A Trust in Mind, or Faith in Mind. But this is much shorter. And he says, simultaneously practice stillness and illumination. Carefully observe, but see no dharmas, see no body, and see no mind. For the mind is nameless, the body is empty, and the dharmas are a dream. There is nothing to be attained, no enlightenment to be experienced. This is called liberation. There is nothing to be attained, no enlightenment to be experienced. This is called liberation. What I love about this is that it points to the fact that this, this experience of the kind of completion or the perfection of things, that nothing is lacking, nothing is missing. It's also the absence of that grasping for nirvana. It's the absence of any and all curative fantasies. Do you kind of just get that? You know, this is from Joko Beck. Enlightenment is not something you achieve. It is the absence of something. All your life, you have been going forward after something, pursuing some goal. Enlightenment is dropping all that. So we, as much as Zen practice talks about stay here, stay with what's happening, don't chase anything, no gain, you know, it's talking about nirvana. It's pointing us to nirvana. It's saying that we suffer and we find our freedom. It depends on us. It depends on how we relate to what's happening. So I wanted to, so I had three main points. One was talking about models of practice. One was talking about nirvana as the absence of something, absence of clinging. And then I want to talk about nirvana and impermanence. In the chanting that we have at the end of the day, we talk about being just this moment. You know, so I would say this is another synonym for nirvana, or another synonym for freedom. What does it mean to be just this moment? What's coming up for me right now is to think about what needs to be let go of in order to fully be this moment. You know, so part of it is letting go of the preference for some other moment, or some, you know, grasping after some perceived better moment, right? To be just this moment. And what I think needs to be let go of is this in some way this sense of separation, or this sense of lack, or the sense of misunderstanding about reality. In the early Buddhist tradition, probably the most emphasized insight, the most emphasized perception, is the perception of impermanence, right? To really open to the changing nature of experience. And I feel like one of the, for me, one of the great awakenings, that's a kind of lofty word, but awakenings that I've had from Barry's approach to Zen practice is making this direct connection between, you know, the perception of impermanence is sort of an abstract word, right? It's pretty, we don't have that much skin in the game when we think about the word impermanence. Today's Saturday, tomorrow's Sunday. Yeah, okay, we're all getting older, yeah. But this drawing this connection between impermanence and the kind of vulnerability and dependency that we hold as human beings living in a relational world. You know, to be in any relationship, I mean, to be alive, right, is to be vulnerable. To be alive is to be dependent. To be in any kind of relationship to another, to love, to trust, to depend on someone, is to open ourselves to vulnerability. You know, so then all of a sudden, wait a second, it's not just like noticing the changing, the way the light is kind of changing, or the changing, which is beautiful practice. You know, the particularities of the breath is, you know, kind of that we do in Vipassana. But it's also to really acknowledge the inescapability of our dependency and vulnerability. And that this is just as important part of impermanence and insight as being with the breath, right? As being with the kind of tiny little details of the breath. So there, you know, is a chant from the early Buddhist tradition. Maybe this is a good place to sort of end. Usually called the Anicca chant, and Anicca means impermanence or change or inconstancy. And this is a chant that's often chanted at funerals, in Buddhist funerals in Thailand and Burma. And the translation of it is, all conditions are impermanent. They arise and they pass away. To come to peace with this truth, to be in harmony with this truth, to come to peace with this truth, is the greatest happiness. You know. So to open to impermanence, to understand and accept and fully realize the impermanence of each moment. We're not getting away from impermanence, you know. It's what there is, right? And to a certain kind of letting go, that contact with impermanence in a deep way, is the greatest happiness. That's another synonym for nirvana. So I feel like the practice of I am my body is this willingness, is profound opening to and acceptance of impermanence, of the truth of impermanence, the truth of selflessness. And when we see this, when we open to this, and fully and thoroughly, you know, maybe as Hagelin would say, accept finitude, accept the limited, well, then maybe in that something unlimited is also present, you know, that it's not just that we accept it, yeah, grudgingly. I don't think a great world tradition would be, yeah, life stinks and then we die, right? Doesn't seem like the basis for a great religion or great, you know. But there's something about opening to the way things are, you know, the truth, you know, what's really true, that not only is freeing, but it lets us really see what is sacred in this, you know, that this, to appreciate and value the beauty, to cherish this world, because it's not lasting, right? So maybe I'll stop there. And these are just some reflections on this topic of nirvana. And we'll have a 5-minute break, and then we'll go into discussion groups.